now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. Today, Manchester City win the EFL Cup for the fourth straight year, but did the scoreline flatter the losers, Spurs? And what next for their talisman, Harry Kane? Fans continue their protests, but what is the perfect club owner? And clubs decide on a social media blackout. We look ahead as well to the Champions League semi-finals on today's episode of The Game. I'm Hugh Wisencroft, joined by three fantastic journalists from The Times as ever, Alison Rudd, Tom Roddy and Gregor Robertson. How are you doing?
Thank you.
Just want to say, flipping heck.
Go on.
If you don't get it, you don't know your football.
Loads for us to discuss. Tom Roddy, you've just spoken to Zinedine Zidane as well. How was he?
That good. He didn't say a whole lot. I mean, the thing is, obviously, the talk this week is all about the European Super League and the fact that the European Super League at the moment is made up of only, three clubs still, Real Madrid being one of them. But Zidane was not joining Klopp and Guardiola and co in criticising it, nor was he endorsing it either. It was a firm no comment and very little more. Hopefully we'll get a bit more from Thomas Tuchel later this afternoon.
Zinedine Zidane doing his own version of 24 hours in police custody. Don't you love those scenes where they're just like no comment 55 times, but there you go. That's the press conference.
Or laying of duty last night.
Listen, don't ruin it. No spoilers here. No spoilers here. I was listening to the radio the other day and genuinely, friends in higher places, I had to message the presenter and say, hold on a minute. You didn't even give us a warning there. You just blurted out what happened on last night's episode. How dare you? How dare you? Well, hopefully there's no spoilers here and everyone's actually seen what happened at Wembley on Sunday, because Manchester City won the first domestic trophy of the season in front of 8,000 fans. Aymeric Laporte's header gave Manchester City a 1-0 win over Spurs and a fourth consecutive Carabao Cup triumph. It could have been more from City, let's be honest. They had 21 shots compared to just two by Spurs, as a Ryan Mason master plan. Well, it never really materialised, did it? Alison, we'll start with the losing side, I think. How bad were Spurs?
Bad enough for me to think, hang on a minute. I thought, this feels like one of those, when we do get them occasionally, where you get, Big Six club playing someone from the division below in a showpiece final, and you think, oh, bless them. They probably thought they could do something, but, you know, they're a bit inexperienced, big occasion, not used to it, haven't got the players, haven't got the tactical now, spit overawed, being toyed with by the much better team. Ridiculous golfing class, absolutely ridiculous. I do not understand why they just didn't sit down and watch the way that Chelsea faced Man City in the FA Cup the previous weekend and worked out that you've got to be patient, you've got to try and control. Try and control the ball at the back, just sort of try and suffocate City, not let them dictate tempo. They were neither attacking nor very well drilled at the back. They improved slightly in the second half, but there were far too many of those silly individual errors, like holding onto the ball too long and then just letting it dribble out of play. Or probably the funniest moment was when Højbjerg tried to play in a pass to Reguilón And it was a dreadful, dreadful pass. And then he started gesticulating like, oh, you're so stupid. I was playing a really good ball. No, you weren't. Everything about the move was disappointing. I don't know why they panicked. It was everything that's bad about when a team gets to Wembley. It was very disappointing, really was. And people in 500 years' time will say that, oh, it was 1-0. Shame. It must have been quite close, but it really wasn't at all.
Gregor, to balance it out, how good were Manchester City?
They were made to look really good by how bad the Spurs were. I think we need to labour on this a little bit, first of all, because they were... I mean, the first half, it's almost... You know, Alison's right in saying you watch the way Chelsea played against them, but Spurs just time and again showed they're not good enough to play it from the back like that. Eric Dier is not good enough to carry the ball out and pick out a pass, and Man City were pressing them. They weren't good enough to play through it. And they seemed to try and play to keep kind of Son and Moura quite narrow. And I think that was with the idea of when they win the ball back, they'll be close to Kane and they're able to spring. But they never won the ball back and they weren't able to keep it, you know, keep it and move it and get it forward quick enough. So Spurs made magic. The City were brilliant and they were full of it, like so high intensity, full of energy. You know, the overloads down the flanks. Spurs just didn't know how to cope with it. Time and wave after attack. But Spurs made them look, you know, they made it easy for them. The first half was just, they looked inept, completely out of their depth. And again, I'll come back to it. It's just truly bizarre that a manager, a 29-year-old manager in Ryan Mason, was the manager of Tottenham Hotspur in a cup final. It's just a bizarre scenario.
Okay, I mean, I don't think anyone else is going to say it, so I will say I think Manchester City played quite well on the day. They're a very good footballing side. Just to add this sentence in for balance, they very much deserve to win the game, and I thought the one goal that they did score was very, very good. So I think that's enough for the Manchester City fans. Because we're not going to get many positive lines out about them.
Well, of course we can. De Bruyne was, you know, when he sometimes looks up and he played that cross to, I think it was Sterling, just like the speed on it. It was all a millimetre away from being perfect. Some of the things that these players do, but we've seen it before. We know how good they are. And Spurs had no plan to stop them. Or if they did, it was completely oblivious to everyone else watching. So, yes, Manchester City. And the other thing I have to give them great credit for is they stuck at it despite missing lots of chances. They stuck at the way that they play, the way that they continue to try and wear teams down. And, yeah, it was surprising that they scored a goal from a set piece. But, I mean, 1-0 was just, you know, looked so kind to Spurs because it should have been 5.
Right, so once again, a compliment to Manchester City, very much yes. Laden with insults about Tottenham Hotspur. Tom, the way that Spurs played, I think we've been through it largely there. Harry Kane, who started the game after injury, what will he be thinking about not just the defeat, but the manner of the defeat?
I think it will have reaffirmed his belief that this summer is the time to go, if he can. That's the key. But I think that game, the way in which it was played, I mean, Alisson and Gregor have rightly gone over how Spurs played. But I thought Paul Hurst's tweet on how it was the most one-sided City game he'd seen, and he watched the FA Cup final, the 6-0 FA Cup final against Watford last year. I think that with Kane, there was talk about the Champions League being key to him sort of wanting to stay at Tottenham. And actually, I'm not entirely sure that would do it. I don't, you know, finishing in the top four is seen, and we'll probably talk about what's going to happen with Arsenal. I don't think qualifying for the Champions League and being a Champions League player will be enough for Harry Kane. So seeing a team that lacked ambition, that lacked direction, that had a manager in the dugout who is one of his best friends, but he believed in what Jose Mourinho could do, and without a manager who is clearly a serial sort of winner and someone who's going to send them in the direction that he wants to go, I think it's just getting much, much clearer to him that this is the time to go.
Alison, do you think the Champions League and possible qualification, if it somehow does come for Spurs, will keep him at the club, or is Tom right? Is that not enough for him? And if he is to leave, does he need to force his way out the door?
Harry Kane may be regretting going public with, you know, him saying if the club aren't going in the right direction, you know, he's not a fool, he will consider his position. So I think deep down he's a very loyal chap. I mean, you know, it's in his blood. I think he'd much prefer to have an option where he could stay and feel he could believe in something happening. I also believe he's put all his eggs now in the Euros basket, because if he is going to force a way out, the club are going to put a very big price tag on him. I think Matt Dickinson today in the Times was talking about 100 million. I mean, who's going to spend that? But if he has a really good Euros, then he will look worth it, and he could secure a move to one of the few clubs with the money to spend that. Unfortunately, Spurs are not one of those clubs who reward players for long service and sort of help them leave. I think they would hold out for a big fee, and then that makes his options limited. But I do like the way Harry Kane, we've always talked like this about him. We've always wondered whether he's too big for Spurs and is he over loyal. And he even if the various teams or managers he plays under falter, he's always so reliable. And if I was thinking, if I had that sort of money and I wanted a striker, I'd be, yes, worried about his ankles, but I'd be very impressed with how it doesn't matter what else is going on. He's still so consistent. I think the final against Man City on Sunday was the one time when, I mean, you think he did but two nice things. That was it. That's the worst performance he's had. And I don't think he was fully fit. Ryan Mason said he didn't train in the build-up to the match. I'm amazed he stayed on the pitch, because he's, you know, he doesn't want something to happen to him that affects his chances of playing in the European Championships. But, you know, maybe that's his greatest strength, that if it doesn't go right for him, if he has to stay at Spurs because they don't help him leave, he'll still be a great player and a great servant to England. And I mean, you know, is that such a terrible thing when he looks back on his career? I don't think so.
Winning no trophies with England and Tottenham for your entire career. Fantastic news, especially for a player.
The English Totty.
Yeah, exactly. The English Totty, who did win a World Cup, though, Tom.
I do wonder whether it would be much easier if they were to win this summer. I think that would actually make it easier for Spurs to convince him to stay. I think that would fill the void for Kane.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, sure.
Gregor.
Get out of the group first.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see if we get out the group. Price plus destination for Harry Kane. Is 100 million a realistic amount of money? Who would pay it?
I mean, it's impossible to say at the moment, apart from PSG and maybe Manchester City, but people keep linking Kane with Manchester City just because it's an easy kind of pairing. But it would fall outside the pattern of signings that have been made, certainly since Pep Guardiola's been there, usually a bit younger. Usually kind of on an upward trajectory. And, you know, Kane is, you know, an absolute guarantee of goals, but he's 28 this summer. I can't see it personally. So it's going to be difficult for him. Yeah, I think there's not many clubs, particularly in the financial climate. We've seen lengths clubs are willing to go to now to try and secure greater revenues in the last week. So he might find himself in a difficult situation. I also think Spurs might see 100 million and go, that's not enough. So he's got to find someone who's willing to pay that. And then he's got to get Spurs willing to accept it. So it's a double whammy for him. It's going to be difficult for him this summer, I think.
I would say that if someone can give some money and maybe a few players, that could make a big difference, particularly if they're the quality of some of the players in the PSG squad or the Manchester City squad. You know, if you get a couple of players plus 60, 70 million pounds, could that change Daniel Levy's mind, particularly if it's in key positions? I don't know. Could an Aymeric Laporte possibly, plus money, plus a Gabriel Jesus maybe? But the point is, I think Manchester City, in the profile of players that they've bought, they haven't had to spend that big over £100 million on a sensational star because they haven't bought a centre forward. You know, they bought Sergio Aguero, who was an up-and-coming player at the time, and he has taken care of that goal chart for the entire time he's been at Manchester City. But they were also an up-and-coming team. Now, they want to be at the elite level. They want to win the Champions League. They want to regularly win the Premier League. And okay, they're doing it right now in terms of the Premier League, but I still think they need that out-and-out, genuine goal scorer. And ultimately, if it's Erling Haaland, for example, or maybe a younger player, that might fit their profile because at least they're spreading the 150, 130, whatever it might be, million pounds over a 10-year period, possibly. That might fit for the club. Harry Kane's maybe a 5-year transfer and it's probably similar money.
I'm more impressed with Harry Kane as Spurs have entered this difficult period. The transition from Pochettino to Mourinho and now Ryan Mason, because he's become a more all-round player. And I think that might keep his value high, Gregor, because I don't see a team that wouldn't want what he brings because of the way he can drop deep and he's prepared to be unselfish and yet still manage to be that egotistical, get all the goals he can player. I mean, look, you know, one of the good things he did in the EFL Cup final was he made a good clearance with his head close to the line. You know, he defends well, he drops deep, he links up play. He's very difficult to mark in the box. He's good on the shoulder of the last defender. He's intuitive. And those things still, Sunday's final aside, those things are getting better for him. I don't see him dropping off. I see him becoming a more all-round player who would fit into any type of manager's philosophy. Do you not think? I still think he's on an upward trajectory.
I absolutely agree. I mean, the only thing is the tendency to have at least one kind of semi-lengthy injury per season. But I absolutely agree. I think he'll be scoring goals almost at this rate when he's 35. Absolutely. But you still have to look at the economic climate and look at which clubs are going to be willing to pay that much this summer, and then look at Spurs' willingness to accept a bid. And I think all those things combined are still going to make it very difficult for him to leave this summer.
I still think he'd be an exceptional prospect. I agree with Alisson. I think the link-up play, the extra that he's added to his game over the past couple of seasons would be massively enticing to a manager like Pep Guardiola. But also, it's rare that you'll buy a golden boot winner who's 28 years old, who scored as many goals as Harry Kane, who's still got that hunger to win trophies because, of course, he hasn't won any. But I wonder if he were to stay at Spurs, Tom, whether they would even try and match his expectation, whether he's the sort of striker who's going in to speak to Daniel Levy, saying, a bit like Wayne Rooney did at Manchester United, you're not bringing in enough quality. This club is not going to be at the top table unless you do more. Will the club match his expectation?
I don't think he's quite as forthright as Rooney was. I think he makes his aspirations clear inside the club. I think the problem is we're seeing a period in which, you know, where is that money going to come from to buy the players they need? One thing just that kind of links to both elements is that performance on yesterday from Spurs struck me as a team who'd been playing under a manager who was focused on defence and then had areas that he focused on in attack, the minimal areas that he focused on attack to get a win. But that had been going on for so long. Whereas when Mourinho took over the team, he basically said, this is a perfect crop of players. This is they're at their peak, at their prime. So I do think there's still the potential in that team. I think there's that element of Mourinho's, which has happened at Man United before and at other clubs before, where suddenly the players aren't good enough. I still think that squad is definitely good enough. So I don't think it actually needs too much. It just needs the right person in charge.
That's quite a commonly held belief. I couldn't disagree much more. I think this team have proven on kind of consistent basis for the last few years. They're on the slide. Some players just aren't playing. Yes, they're playing. You know, it grew a bit stale under Pochettino. Then under Mourinho, it was kind of, we know what kind of descended into the atmosphere and whatnot. But I still think they're miles banged, miles off. They've gone backwards in this kind of 3 years since Kane said, I want to see a bit of progress, and I'd like to hope in the next few years I may have some silverware. They've gone backwards. And, you know, there's like people try, you see on TV, there are these debates about picking out who's the best, you know, which players can you say, yeah, he's good enough to play in a top team in the Premier League. Everyone's is citing Reguilon these days. No chance. No chance. There's a reason why he's not at Real Madrid. Like, there's some weeks he looks like, yeah, well, he should be playing for Real Madrid, or he should be playing for a top team in the Premier League. And then other weeks he looks like he should be playing for Brighton. And the reason, and what happens in the end is you play for Spurs, who are in the middle. There are very few players, I think, in that Spurs team who you can say good enough to play in a top team in the Premier League, like a team challenging for the Premier League. They've gone backwards.
While we're on Tottenham then, what sort of prospect are they for the new manager, whoever that might be, in terms of who they might be able to bring in, but also what they've currently got to offer? You think of some of the players in the squad who've been, you know, widely criticised, of course, defensively. Eric Dier's there, Davinson Sanchez, Joe Roden, Serge Aurier, Ben Davies, Reguilon, who you've already mentioned. You go into the midfield, Harry Winks, question marks there, Dele Alli, question marks, Sissoko, massive moment in the game, losing Laporte for the goal, but you know, not a regular starter anyway. And Ndombele's had question marks, Giovanni Lo Celso's had question marks, both big money signings, the previous two. You've got Bergwijn, who's okay, in and out, Bale, who's not going to be there. You know, Carlos Vinicius, what do you offer the new manager, Gregor?
I mean, Ndombele is someone who kind of, you look at the skills and the kind of flair he has and the talent, and his productivity is almost zero. Like, he doesn't create or score goals. And that might be something to do with the team he's playing in. And he's obviously a highly talented player. There's too many players who flatter to deceive. Aurier yesterday, that challenge, it was just like, how many times do you have to see that occur before you think he can't be playing in Tottenham Hotspur's team? Like, and I know Matt Doherty's come in and he's not set the world alight either. It's just, if I was a Spurs fan, I'd look at that group of players and think the majority of them have gone backwards.
Well, it's a pretty scathing assessment of the Tottenham Hotspur squad. Maybe fans will be protesting against the players very soon, because they were protesting against the hierarchy at the club before the EFL Cup final at Wembley and the team's decision to sign up to, I guess, the now failed European Super League. Some signs said Levy out, fingers pointed at their chairman Daniel Levy, of course, for Spurs. But Arsenal supporters on Friday night before their game against Everton had a very large demonstration outside the Emirates Stadium as well. And they are not the only clubs where fans have been very unhappy of late. And Tom Roddy, it got us thinking about fans. What do they really want from their owners? And is it realistic? What do you think?
Really, they want lots of things. They want a say in what goes on. They want signings. They want ambition. They want aspirations. But probably the main thing they want, which is why we're seeing such anger at Arsenal, is kind of a form of access to the owners. And that doesn't have to be a sit-down chat, but just some form of communication. Hence why Stan Kroenke has been nicknamed Silent Stan at Arsenal. And it's not always realistic that these things can happen, especially when you get people, billionaires who aren't used to the football industry, come in where they have a say, where they control what happens, and then suddenly the expectations around football are completely different. So there kind of has to be a little bit of a meeting in the middle there. And I think for Arsenal alone, I mean, we sort of saw their fury of the Super League turn towards Kroenke last week. And I think it represents the slide they've had. And I think almost the most worrying thing of what came out of that was the fans forum chat on Friday with Josh Kroenke, the Arsenal director, and Stan's son. almost suggesting that they would be investing in the squad this summer. And that tells you kind of everything you need to know about their perception of fans and English football, that the main thing they want is players and signings, and that kind of taps into their idea of the difference between legacy fans and their how did they describe the global fans, was it?
We'll come to what's happening at Arsenal in a few moments' time. Alison, I wanted to ask you what you think it achieves, fans protesting against the owners. Do they ever, in your experience, act on it?
Well, I was at Stamford Bridge on Tuesday night. Unless it was just one big coincidence, and actually partly it was, but one club had to be the first to buckle, and it was, by a few minutes, Chelsea. And the fans were, I don't know, it's kind of counterintuitive, but it wasn't a well-organised display. It was from the heart, almost, apart from one flag, every single banner, piece of cardboard had been put together that day or within the 10 minutes before they turned up. It was so... It was just so real. It wasn't manufactured. It was genuine anger. And you really felt you were getting proper local core fans there. There's a lot of counterintuitive stuff going on here, because actually I don't think there is a big move amongst fans to be have control of the clubs. You know, the 51% rule. There isn't a clamour for that. They do what they do want is a relationship. And at Chelsea, for all that you could paint a political picture of Roman Abramovich as being an unsavoury character, in a footballing sense, he's quite loved by Chelsea fans. He does do a lot locally and he doesn't make a big deal of it. You only know about it if you live there. He's in it not to make money. He's in it because he just likes English football. So there's actually always been quite a nice relationship between an oligarch and their core support. And he did not like the fact that there were signs saying, you know, are three yachts not enough for you? So this sense that he could be a benefactor, a rich benefactor, and he was in danger of just not being liked, let alone not being loved. I think that was part of it. It was threatening to destroy all his years of proving to Chelsea fans that they come first, almost. That the high churn of managers at Chelsea sounds like a bad thing to do, but he manages to do it and make the fans feel, yeah, we like the way this club's run, because he's going to pay big money for the next manager and he likes the players and he puts the players first. So the fact that you got this hastily cobbled together 1,000 fans at Stamford Bridge, they were quite amusing with their songs. The placards were funny, but also sort of full of pain. And it within 20 minutes or so, the announcement came, actually, we're not going to do it. And that I think, what was the question here? What were they hoping to achieve? They were hoping to make a reconnection. They were hoping to say, hang on a minute, this isn't you. You've gone too far. We want to feel that we have a product here that remembers that it isn't actually much of a product without us being on your side. And so in that sense, it was quite emotional and quite powerful. And I was really glad I was there.
The reason that there's such a contrast between the goodwill of supporters at Chelsea towards Abramovich and the negativity that surrounds Kroenke at Arsenal is because of the difference of the two clubs from when those people arrived. I mean, Chelsea fans see the club in the position that it is now, this elite club in European football, as due to his money, which is right. Whereas since Kroenke came in, Arsenal have been on this, I was going to say gradual slide, but it's the gradient's getting sharper. I think that's the key. It's the context of where it's the journey. And I wonder as well, we had Abramovich has sort of turned it round a little bit at Chelsea, because we had that period where the plans for Stamford Bridge's redevelopment got shelved when his visa there was a delay in approving his visa by the government, and then there were question marks over whether he was actually interested in Chelsea anymore, whether it had all kind of gone. And I think it clearly hadn't, because of the investment in the squad last summer. But you do wonder if they hadn't invested and Chelsea had began to slide, I wonder whether fans then suddenly start to turn and think, okay, it's time to go. It's time to, if the club starts to slide like Arsenal did.
I've no doubt that Abramovich likes Chelsea and English football, but let's not kid ourselves for a second. That's why he bought the club. That's a roasting interview if I've ever heard one. So
no. All I was saying was the reason I spoke to fans, Gregor, and I said, "Why are you here?" And they said, "Because we're surprised Abramovich wants to join the Super League, because he's not in it for the money. Yes, he's in it for lots of other reasons, but he's not in it for the money. He's not in it to make money."
Yeah, he's garnered a lot of goodwill, and that was threatened to be trashed. But the question is, what do supporters want? The first answer is success. Let's not kid ourselves about that. And if it's not success and they're slightly more realistic, then it's ambition. That's the next thing. And then they want engagement, transparency. And that's what they feel is being lost. And also a kind of, as I said last week, we've hit a barrier where the kind of overwhelming force of the commercial kind of, you know, the desire to increase revenues, ever more viewers and content and all that, is just kind of gone too far, and the, you know, the root, the heritage of the communal community side of the football clubs is being kind of, was being left in the dust in the distance. I think that is the thing, that there's been a widespread kind of acceptance and realization in the last week, and we're seeing that supporters are kind of feel that we've come to the end of the line. I read that Arsenal's supporters trust has seen their membership double in the last week, so they may not want to be, you know, majority owned, and that at that level, it's probably unrealistic. Let's be honest about that. But they want to be heard, and they want at least to be able to have a conversation. And at the moment, many of them can't even do that.
Well, that's something that was clarified over the weekend, because so many people were talking about the 50+1 rule in Germany and saying it was about 50% ownership, 51% ownership. But really, for most of the clubs in Germany, it's about the fans having 51% of the votes to help the club make decisions on vital things so that they have a say. And maybe that is something that could change going forward.
Although, as Ian Hockey wrote in the Times today, both Real Madrid and Barcelona have, you know, voting... they have voting rights, and so their decision would have gone to the members, and actually they are going to vote on it, I believe. So, you know, there's no straightforward answer to this. But ultimately, it's the kind of the commercial had vastly overtaken the kind of communal community soul of football. I think that's what everyone's realised.
I mean, you're right to point out it's about that engagement and transparency, and I think these protests were a lot to do with, you know, not just the fans being kept in the dark, but people insulted by the fact the players, the management, even chairman had been kept in the dark over the plan for the European Super League. But Greg, you were in football. In your experience, do you think we have an issue with ownership in English football, really? And do you think we need to do something drastic to change it?
Yeah, we undoubtedly have an issue with ownership, but it's kind of multi-layered. I was at Southend United at the other end of the scale, who are about to, well, look like they will be relegated from the Football League. They got a win against Leighton Orient to drag it out another few days at least. But their owner has owned the club for 23 years. You know, any fair-minded supporter would admit that he's a property developer. He came into the club with a view of building a new stadium, and it's taken 2 decades, and they're getting quite close to that coming to fruition. But in the meantime, in the last few years, it looks like he's kind of been hit in the pocket a little bit financially by various things, and his funding's been reduced a bit, and they're going to slide out the Football League. So, you know, I think he's loaned the club something like £20 million in that time frame, and this is a lower league club. So there's no way he's going to sell until he gets a return on his investment. There's associated housing development with the building of a new stadium. So that, you know, ultimately, a football club's fate can be so tied to the finances of one individual, and a property deal is not right, in my view, because the club suffers in the meantime, and the clubs are left The club supporters are left completely helpless, just watching on. They feel they protested before the game. They feel completely powerless. So there are many layers to it. Whether it's a kind of people talk about a more stringent owners and directors test. They want something in place where there's like perhaps a licensing system that means that you don't just pass the owners and directors test and then that's it. You're free to stay at a football club for 23 years and watch it fall out the Football League. Perhaps a license system would mean that it could be revoked, or you could enforce a sale, or you could separate the stadium with the other issues. So that it's not straightforward. But undoubtedly, something has to be done to protect football clubs from individuals that come in to buy a football club and they have motives that don't align with the best interests of a football club, essentially.
Let's talk about Arsenal very quickly then. Daniel Ek, the Spotify billionaire, the music streaming site founder, reports today that he will be approaching Stan Kroenke to try and buy the club. He's got Thierry Henry, Patrick Vieira and Dennis Bergkamp helping him, I guess, advising him on that. And maybe all three could return to the club as part of this move, Tom. I don't think it's true, but it could be.
I didn't know a hell of a lot about Daniel Ek, but my first impression of him is that he must be quite a romanticist, because a guy who gets Henri, Bergkamp and Vieira, this kind of Avengers assemble. And then I learned that he had Bruno Mars performing at his wedding. This sort of cliched romanticist that he clearly is. But I wondered as well, you know, the timing of that, I mean, he registered his interest, for anyone that doesn't know, he registered his interest in buying Arsenal over social media on Friday night as fans were protesting outside the ground, which is partly why I think Arsenal have been sceptical over whether this interest is real, because it felt a little bit opportunistic at the time. And it's kind of having just spoken about what do fans want. I think whenever you hear of someone who runs a company and founded a company like Spotify that's worth, I think, around £52 billion, whenever you fans hear that, they jump at it, they clamour for it. This idea of, I mean, we saw it with Newcastle and Mike Ashley. Any possibility of someone who can take over at the time when they're feeling this sort of vitriol towards the owner, they immediately jump for it. But I'd also have sort of question marks over someone who puts their kind of hat in the ring over Twitter. Maybe that's the modern way of football and using social media. But it's, I think as well, we also know, I mean, I think his net worth, according to Forbes, is $3.5 billion. And again, it says a lot that he would probably need to be part of a consortium for this to actually happen, or have a partner involved as well.
It's a very, very good advert for Spotify, isn't it? That's what it is. He might mean it. I mean, he might mean it, as you say, Tom, in a romantic sense. Wouldn't we all like to own our clubs? My children were saying, they were saying to me, "Mum, why don't you buy Liverpool?" You'd be really popular. We think you'd be a great owner. And we know the first thing you do is you say, "Right, okay, I'm going to plough in X billion, but we've got to buy Gylfi Sigurdsson tomorrow." They know me so well. But it's a great advert for Spotify. So it's fantastical. It might be self-serving, and it's definitely, as Tom says, it's definitely romantic. And I would really love to fast forward 20 years and that deal has gone through, and you will see there will be protests outside the stadium because that consortium has failed to deliver the title, and it has failed to buy the players the fans wanted. And the romance never lasts, no matter how many goals you scored for the club in the past.
Well, yeah, that is true, but it almost takes the clock back, you know, 30-40 years. Rich fan, and he's a supporter, and I think that's the other thing that made Arsenal fans interested in this, you know, someone that maybe passionately cares about the club, as opposed to this rather cold American who rarely comes out from wherever he's hiding to talk about the club, who probably doesn't know, you know, five of the first 11 players in their starting lineup. You know, that they want that someone who cares about the results and might micromanage the club, as a opposed to someone who keeps it at arm's length. And that's another thing about football ownership currently. Lots of owners who, you know, see it as one of their foreign investments. And you know, that's the ultimately how football is these days. I don't see how these protests change that. And that's the other thing. We've spoken about it a lot over the past couple of podcasts, but even government legislation, the more I think about it, won't make the people that own football clubs care about them. And ultimately, that's what we want as football fans, people that care about the club as much as we do. Whether they sort of run it perfectly or not is another situation, but I think it starts with that. Anyway, we can move on, Gregor, unless your furrowed brow has something else to add.
Well, no, I would just say that fan protests have worked. I would point to clubs, many clubs lower down the football league, such as Blackpool, who boycotted their owner essentially for 3.5-4 years, something like that.
It took 4 years. I'm not going to say they didn't have.
It worked in the end. Fans making their voice known, and ultimately withdrawing their spending can definitely have an impact. That's more at a lower level, but there's so many different aspects to this, and I think just competency is, you know, proving that you show some sign of knowing what you're doing and have the best interests of the club in your, you know, at heart. And there are many owners throughout the country who really fail that very basic test, I think, whether it be kind of wildly flailing around in the transfer market and then that putting the club into debt, and then that seeing the club fall through the leagues and then threaten their very future because of the debts can't be repaid. You know, those are the kind of things that there have to be protections against. But ultimately, you can never ever protect fully against the actions of owners at all levels of football.
I don't think that fan protest works alone at this level, but I don't think it would have worked last week. It was because you had players, managers, the Prime Minister, the future King coming out against it. I think that was why. I don't think fan protest alone would have reversed this.
Final word on this. If Spotify take over Arsenal, do the players get paid £1.20 per goal?
Yeah,
that's a good return compared to musicians.
I was about to say, yeah, it's maybe a few pennies for the musicians, which is another question mark over how Daniel Ek will be received if he were to buy Arsenal. There's a long way to go on that. I don't think Stan Kroenke is up for selling anytime soon. Remember, if you're enjoying yourself, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times today for 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. You can get more of our award-winning journalism across all of your devices.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Protests against football club owners isn't the only sign that we've had recently of people within the sport taking a stand, let's call it that. There's going to be a 3-day social media blackout It will last from Friday night until Monday night, taking part a coalition of the FA, Premier League, EFL, PFA, LMA, the PGMOL, Kick It Out, Women in Football, and the Football Supporters Association. Many clubs and players will take part as well, all with the goal of emphasising that social media companies must do more to eradicate online hate and discrimination. So we asked about what those protests outside grounds would achieve. Alison, what will a social media blackout achieve?
It makes the news headlines, which is good. I think it probably makes those people who post racist comments feel even more powerful. Look what they've done. Look what they've managed to break the system. They've managed to shut it down. The interesting thing is that the social media companies have come back and said they are trying and they are doing more and they have shut down accounts and they have dealt with X hundreds of abusers. I would like to see those made public. I mean, we have to name and shame, don't we? It is illegal to be racist. So it means nothing to me to read that Instagram or Twitter have dealt with people who've been posting racist stuff. I want to know who they are, where they live, and the fact it's written down that they will not be allowed to be on any social media again. Because unless you ally it to something like that, merely boycotting social media just makes idiots feel powerful. You have to also embarrass them acutely. And if people know they're going to be named and shamed and told they're blacklisted forever, they will carry on. Nothing will stop. They'll just open another account. They might go off Twitter for a few weeks and start somewhere else. They need to be joined up between all social media accounts, that once you've broken the law, been racist, you're not allowed back on, and that this is public knowledge that you're not allowed back on. And also, let's see exactly how they're monitoring how these things are set up. So in that sense, if the boycott is the start of something, the start of making the owners worried so that they will, we're going to have to really, really take this seriously and do more than just say the right things, then it is a good thing. Otherwise, it's not. But hopefully it is the start of something like that. But, you know, name and shame, for goodness sake. Who are all these people who are allowed to be anonymous? Let's stop that.
Yeah, it goes and no to all those conversations about whether you would give that information over to these social media companies. A big element of trust or distrust, if you like, sits in the middle of all of this. Tom, do you think that the social media companies will listen and act to football clubs and those in the game?
I'm not sure whether this will be enough this weekend. I think they'll see it as something which disappears, maybe. You know, it's sort of this weekend, it will be huge. I remember the hashtag enough. You had the social media sort of blackouts that a lot of the players were doing. And it was very powerful, wasn't it? Do you remember sort of scrolling through and seeing, used to seeing beaches in Bali and all these sorts of things and people holidaying, and suddenly you were seeing just these black squares, and it was extremely powerful, but then nothing really happened. And I fear that the same thing will happen. The difference is that there's just more people involved now. I mean, it was a similar thing we were talking about Thierry Henry earlier. He's not on social media anymore, you know, because of this. He said he won't be involved until social media companies bring in proper regulation. And I'd forgotten about that until this morning, because it just hits the headlines and it's huge, and then you sort of forget about it because nothing is done. Maybe it's the pessimist in me that thinks that it's fallen on deaf ears so many times, and I just don't feel like even this weekend, even with the amount of followers that the Premier League and all its players and all its all the club's followers have, will reach. I still don't. I think, you know, Monday, Tuesday, it will go back to normal, and they'll see it as it'll brush over.
This alone is not going to change anything, no. But I think we can see that there's some momentum building. Yeah, you know, a bit of anger, really, about how there's been a lack of action and seems to be bigger priorities than dealing with racist abuse. When you look at Jordan Henderson's handed his Twitter account over to CyberSmile, I think it's called, to raise awareness of abuse that many of his teammates have been subjected to. I think, you know, Swansea, Birmingham Rangers, Tom mentioned Henri. There is a kind of a bit of momentum, I think. But I personally think that the future could lie in some sort of technology. You know, there's been reading things about the software where you can, it essentially makes abuse disappear in real time. So the kind of keywords and stuff. So I think that's the kind of avenue that should be explored as well. Social media companies aren't going to make people verify accounts. It's not going to happen. So we need to look at other ways. And, you know, this is a way of making it clear that something has to be done. But I think probably technology might end up providing the answer.
Let's move ahead and look ahead then to the games coming up in the Champions League this week. We haven't got long left. So let's look ahead to the semi-final. Some massive games coming. Chelsea visit Real Madrid, fresh from their win over West Ham. It boosts their Champions League hopes as well. It's Paris Saint-Germain against Manchester City. Let's start with the game in Spain, though, Tom. Timo Werner scoring at the weekend against West Ham. Do you stick with him for the game against Real Madrid, or should it be someone like Kai Havertz or, dare I say, Olivier Giroud?
I think Werner will possibly play, but I think we're going to see Kai Havertz come back in as a false nine. And the reason being, because this is a Champions League semi-final, most people would expect, especially with the Zinedine Zidane team and a Thomas Tuchel team, that it's going to be pretty tight. There's not going to be a lot of space, and that's what Timo Werner thrives off, space. So I think Tuchel will look instead to bring Havertz back in and try and sort of break Madrid down, really. I think they'll go in pretty optimistic, which they should do. They just control games so much at the moment, Chelsea. And they have a nice, a lovely balance to them. And they seem set up perfectly for knockout games, for Champions League knockout games. I mean, we've spoken in the past, and we will speak about Manchester City, but in the past, what we've seen from them is the kind of total opposite of that, where it all kind of goes a little bit gung-ho and everything goes out the window, and and they end up on the end of a bit of a thrashing at these latter stages. Chelsea don't seem like that this year. They tend to be quite in control of games. I think some people might call it dull or boring. At this stage, that will not matter to anyone there.
Alison, what do you think? Olivier Giroud, the man for a night like this?
I doubt he'll start, but I think the key person is Mateo Kovacic and whether he's going to be fit, and I don't think he is. I think he brings so much intelligence and control that I think if he is fit, Chelsea could beat anybody, to be quite honest, because he's got the personnel to lay the ball off to or ping passes to that can destroy teams. Their system is really quite seductive. I agree with Tom. They've got it nailed. So I think he'll play a part, Giroud. He's so intelligent that he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't like being told he's good at coming off the bench, but he's very good at assessing a game, working out where the space might be, and maybe getting the important goal just by sort of sniffing it out.
Paris Saint-Germain against Manchester City, Alisson. Do you think John Stones and Ruben Dias can take care of Neymar and Mbappe?
Of course not. I mean, but again, there are rumours that Mbappe might not be fully fit. And if he's not, then I'd make City favourites, I think. Because more than anything, I don't think they're necessarily a one-man team, PSG, but I do think it would knock their confidence if Mbappe wasn't fit and available, because he's been so integral to them getting this far. But I don't. I just feel City are always vulnerable to real intelligent pace, and probably the team with the most intelligent raw pace at the moment is PSG. So if Mbappe's fit, I think there might be a few bits of blushing going on the noses of those defenders. Do people blush on their nose? I don't know. I saw them blushing on their nose.
Yeah, you're right. If Kylian Mbappe doesn't start, it could be massive. If he's injured for one game, He's been huge so far in 2020. I think he's got 21 in 25 goals. I mean, it's just ridiculous, 21 goals in 25 games. Gregor, I just wanted to end with you in terms of predictions for both games. I know you love them. So how do you feel, firstly, about this PSG-Manchester City game?
I think this one's really hard to call. I'm sure you'll be glad to hear me say that. I think, well, to be fair, as much as we hammered Spurs earlier, that was the best performance City have had in a while. They could kind of lose their fluency a little bit in recent weeks. So that would be hugely encouraging for them going into this game. I hope I'm right in saying that it could be something a bit more along the lines of the Bayern PSG game, and that these are two teams that don't generally bend the way they're going to play for an opponent. I think could see lots of goals in that one. I think another one, as Tom said, I think it's likely to be a bit cagier. And just every time I see Chelsea play, I'm just more and more impressed with the way that so hard to break down and so hard to get through. And with a back three that, you know, Silva come in and he's towards the end of his career. Rudiger and Christensen, if they're playing, they've had pretty up and down Chelsea careers. Aspilicueta often playing in the back three, and that seems to be somewhere it'll suit him for, you know, as he gets a little bit older. You don't look at them all and think this is a kind of the foundation for a defence that's going to keep so many clean sheets, and yet they are, and that's to do with the structure and as Tom said, the balance. You know, obviously they're coming up against a bit of a more illustrious opponent in Real Madrid this time, but I still think Chelsea have got a good chance. Is that predictions?
All English final?
I don't think it's beyond the realms. I think I'd actually give Chelsea a better chance than City. You know, as much as City are such a threat going forward, they still just do have that kind of weak spot. And I know it seems obvious just to say that City are vulnerable to the counter and they're playing against Mbappe and Neymar, but either Pep tries to somehow outthink them, which has never ended well in the past, to kind of, you know, to overcome that threat, or that is the obvious threat, and pace is something that's very hard to deal with unless you sit deep. And City aren't going to do that. So I personally think Chelsea have got a better chance of getting to the final.
Alison, who's got the best chance?
PSG Chelsea final.
You've got a full house.
Oh, really? Well, I see Manchester City Real Madrid as the final, actually. I just think Manchester City will control things, and I think they can learn a lot of lessons from the Bayern Munich exit, in that they controlled both games pretty much and were still beaten. Hopefully Pep's got a decent plan for that this time. Once again, if I see three at the back, I will lose my mind. Pep, please no. And I just think Real Madrid are a better side than Chelsea right now. I know that they're more beatable than Chelsea, but I just think going forward, it's going to be a tight game. It's going to be a tight game, both legs, I think. But I think Real Madrid might pit the first one at home 1-0, maybe get a 1-1 draw back at Stamford Bridge. Who knows? Away goals could be the difference, but I think it's going to be a low-scoring affair. I just got a feeling that City and Real Madrid's the final this year. I'll leave it for a few more weeks before I call the winner as well. But thank you, Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Tom Roddy, for being with me for the past hour or so, and for all of you for listening as well. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times right now for more of our award-winning journalism across all of your devices. Just go online today, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started.
I'm Eric. I'm Spartacus. Thank you.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.